I see aquaponics as a really powerful tool for what we call food sovereignty, right? There's this idea that food security is just providing the calories for people in a community that might be currently experiencing hunger. And that's great. But food sovereignty takes it to the next level, where it's really the community deciding what kind of food they're eating and how much and what varieties and how it's connected to their traditional heritage and their climate and things like that. And so I think aquaponics is a really powerful tool for that in the right hands and if it's done in the right way.
You're listening to Visionary Aquaponics, a podcast dedicated to aquaponics for backyard and commercial growers, water security in times of drought, urban desert food security, and permaculture integration. Listen for tips on passive solar design, business strategies, fish breeding, and other entrepreneurial advice from the world's pioneers and visionaries in the global aquaponics movement for food freedom and water wisdom. And now, here's your host, Maribou Latour.
Hey, Aqua Tribe, you're listening to the Visionary Aquaponics Podcast with your host, Maribou Latour, aka Aquapotis. Today, I want to welcome you to this episode with Adam Brock, the co-founder of Grow House in Colorado, which is a nonprofit, and we'll be talking more about that. Adam, are you ready to inspire a global aquaponics movement?
Yeah, you bet.
Awesome. So we really want to know about the Grow House. Tell us, where is it and what do you guys do there and how did it start?
Yeah, so the Grow House is a very unique nonprofit based in my hometown of Denver, Colorado. It's in a neighborhood of Denver that I never really knew existed growing up, but obviously I've become very close with now, called Elyria Swansea. It's part of this old industrial area kind of along the train tracks and the river that goes through Denver. It's one of the oldest communities in Denver. It's always been a working class neighborhood, and it's kind of surrounded by industrial infrastructure, highways and factories and things like that. And in the middle of this neighborhood was an old greenhouse that a flower company used to use to kind of make all their bouquets with cut flowers that they got shipped in from farms outside of town. And they left about 10 years ago. This old greenhouse was sitting vacant. And then it was purchased by a developer who had an interest in local food and social justice. He was like, wow, this greenhouse that's in the middle of this low-income community, which, of course, as in so many communities across the country with these similar demographics, it's a food desert. There's lack of access to healthy food. And so he said, you know, wouldn't it be amazing if we transform this old industrial space into a thriving community hub? And so he had this big idea. You know, he had heard of other places around the country like Growing Power, but, you know, he was a developer. He's not a aquaponics person or a permaculturalist. And so that's kind of where I came in the picture. I met him through a mutual friend. And the two of us, as well as a couple other activists and experts, started scratching our heads and said, wow, what could we do with this kind of fallen apart space? We started talking to the community there. It's largely an immigrant Latino community, and really tried to listen to what their needs were and their ideas. We, you know, got our 501c3 together. We got a board of directors. We started, you know, just bit by bit with the little scraps of funds we were able to raise, experimenting with different small-scale aquaponic systems and teaching workshops and things like that. And, you know, now 5 years later, we've put almost $1 million of renovations into the building. We have two commercial farms side by side, a hydroponic and an aquaponic. We have a community market where people from the neighborhood can get, you know, very high-quality local organic foods at very cheap prices. We teach classes for hundreds of people in the neighborhood per year and thousands of students. And it's really just become this amazing hub, not just for that neighborhood, but for all of Denver to learn about where their food comes from, how to get more engaged in the food system. And so, you know, I feel kind of just, although I'm the co-founder, I feel very much swept along by this movement that's much bigger than me or any one person.
Wow. That sounds so amazing. So when did this start? And was it just you and this developer, or were there a few other co-founders involved?
Yeah, this was in 2009 that the developer, his name is Paul Tamborello, he bought the building in 2009, and I got involved a few months after he bought it. And he was actually alerted to the fact that this building existed in the first place by a couple of food justice activists in Denver, Ashara Ekundayo and Kendra Sandoval. And then myself and Ashara and Paul were kind of the three co-founders. Pretty soon after, I actually brought in one of my childhood friends growing up named Kobe Gould. He's now the executive director. And so he and I were kind of co-directors for a long time. Also, very early on, we brought on JD and Tanya Sawyer, who are our aquaponics experts. They run Colorado Aquaponics, so I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with their work. And so they're really the people that run our aquaponics farm and that whole end of things. And then, you know, the whole time there's been many, many volunteers, interns, community members. So, you know, like I said, it is truly a kind of tribe of folks that have been making this happen.
Wow, that sounds so cool. That's so inspiring. So tell us how you guys came up with the name Grow House, and what was the process of talking with the community and figuring out what the needs were?
Yeah, totally. So the name Grow House was actually Ashara's idea, and it's spelled H-A-U-S, and she wanted to reflect the, you know, like I said, it's a Latino community now, but originally the heritage of that neighborhood was Eastern European, German, Slavic, Czechoslovakian, things like that. And so she wanted to honor that heritage. That's a really important thing to her. And so we went with that. In terms of, you know, really our community process, you know, the very first principle of permaculture is observe and interact, right? And so what that says is that you really can't understand any complex system, whether we're talking about an ecosystem or a group of community members, without really becoming a part of it and integrating yourself into it, becoming a participant observer. I mean, using all five senses, using your rational mind as well as your kind of spirit and body. I mean, engaging on all those levels. And so, you know, we tried to put as much time as we could into really just integrating into the community and understanding what made it tick before we made any big decisions about, you know, what we thought was the best idea. We didn't want to impose our own kind of what we were particularly interested in upon the neighborhood. We wanted to work hand in hand with the neighborhood. And so we had community listening sessions where we just brought people in and had a dialogue. We made a point to go out of our way to visit, you know, like the school play at the elementary school, to go to church services on Sunday morning, because that's a big thing in that neighborhood, to learn who are the community leaders and what is the history of the neighborhood, what have been some of the struggles and some of the successes of past decades, and really, you know, try and get a pulse of everything that goes on in that neighborhood. How is it? You know, it is almost all Latino, but within that, there's so much diversity of people who have been there for many generations and are homeowners and speak Spanish or speak English at home. And then people who have just arrived from Mexico and don't know English. And so, you know, what are all the nuances of that and the conflicts between those different communities? And so, you know, lots and lots to learn, and you can't learn it overnight. So, you know, we went in with the idea that we need to earn the trust of this community. And because of the history of outsiders coming in and saying they were going to help and actually making things worse, that, you know, there's a lot of skepticism to overcome. And so we knew it was going to take years. And the truth is, it took about 4 years of that process of listening and building and offering a hand and responding to what we'd heard before community members really started to turn the corner and say, okay, these guys are for real. They're in it for the right reasons. We're going to start showing up and telling our friends. And, you know, that's kind of when the corner turned and we started to get more and more community members in the door.
Wow. So it sounds like you guys really, you know, you wanted to make a difference and you had ideas about food being a part of it. What was your background? The other co-founder, you said, is a developer. And how did you get into permaculture and food, the food movement?
So, you know, like I said, I grew up here in Denver. My parents had a big garden. They cooked all the time. And as a child, I was not interested in any of that. You know, they couldn't tear me away from my Legos and my computer games and my drum set. So it was, ironically enough, when I was in college in the middle of New York City, I went to NYU at a program where I got to make up my own major, that I actually started getting interested in sustainability after, you know, taking classes and learning about climate change and the scope of, you know, environmental destruction that we're causing. And from there, you know, learning more and more about all kinds of different issues around sustainable energy systems and ecological design, which then led me to permaculture, which then led me to sustainable food production, which I saw very quickly was kind of at the nexus of solving so many challenges that we're facing as a society, not just climate change, but social justice and inequality, you know, the reinvention of our cities and things like that. So after all that, you know, I took my permaculture design course, actually for credit, my last semester of college in New York City with an amazing teacher named Andrew Faust.
Oh, I know Andrew Faust. That's great.
Yeah, he's an awesome guy. I actually met him right after he moved to New York. He had been homesteading in West Virginia for, you know, like a dozen years. And we happened to be living like six blocks away from each other in Brooklyn. And so I started hanging out with him and helped him organize his first PDC in New York, and then took that PDC and then took a teacher training the next year with Dave Jackie and a bunch of...
Me too!
Oh, nice. Cool. Yeah.
That sounds great. So you've been trained by Andrew Faust and Dave Jackie.
Yep. And then I moved back to Denver because, you know, I wanted to take all this stuff that I was learning and apply it to my native habitat, you know, my community that I knew the best. And so I was, you know, moved back to Denver, was surprised to find that there really weren't many people teaching permaculture or actively, you know, outwardly practicing it in Denver. And so just kind of had to find my own path, but had the great fortune to be able to collaborate with, you know, we brought in Toby Hemingway to teach our first PDC here in Denver. And so I learned a lot from him. He brought in folks like Larry Santoyo and Penny Livingston. I started teaching at the Central Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute with Jerome Osentowski, who's, you know, one of the elders in this national movement. He teaches with Peter Bain. So I've really had the good fortune to be mentored by some of these really, really incredible people within the movement over the last, you know, 6-7 years or so. So that was kind of my introduction to permaculture and how I ended up doing all that good stuff.
Wow, that's incredible. It sounds like we have some similar pathways, you know, as far as studying some of the global problems and being frustrated by that, and then seeing how there are solutions through ecological design and energy and food production, and especially water. Water is a big one.
Yeah, totally. Water is a huge one, especially, you know, where I live here in Colorado.
Yeah, and where I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico, it's always been a driving focus of my studies. And like you, I also went to a school where I developed my own curriculum. Uh-huh. And it was all around sustainability and permaculture and sustainable water systems, sustainable food systems, appropriate technologies like rocket stoves, agroforestry, and all that. So I've taken multiple permaculture courses as well, and did Dave Jackie's permaculture teacher training last year. In addition to, you know, aquaponics training courses, yeah. I really got into aquaponics through permaculture, actually. And through learning about living machines, eco machines, and
sure.
You know, what the New Alchemy Institute was doing back in, I think, the 70s in Boston, or in Cape Cod, actually.
Yep.
I think. Yeah. And so that sounds amazing. So you were going on this whole journey in permaculture world and working with people like Toby Hemingway and Larry Santoyo and Peter Bain, and found this developer, and then really just set roots in this nonprofit. And so tell us about some of the classes and some of the things that you guys have developed over time now that, you know, you got it going, and what have you guys accomplished and what kinds of classes do you offer?
So, you know, one of the things that's been part of our vision since day one is that, you know, again, permaculture, all this ecological stuff, it's about looking at the big picture, right? And looking at holism and trying to integrate rather than segregate. So what we said is, in this greenhouse, which is about a half acre, by the way, 20,000 square feet, we wanted to really encompass all these different aspects of the food system under one roof. And so in particular, we wanted to really be looking at food production, food distribution, and food education, and really see how all three of those things, you know, could work together and synergize. So yeah, there's the production and the farms, and we can talk about that later. There's the distribution, getting that food to the people that need it the most. And then, yeah, one of the most important parts, like you're mentioning, is education, our classes. And we have classes for people of all ages and backgrounds, lots of different programs. So, you know, we have a service learning program for school groups. It's basically, you know, field trips. They come for anywhere from an hour and a half to all day, anywhere from preschoolers all the way and up to college students and grad students. And so for each group, we kind of come up with a custom curriculum that's some mix of kind of interactive group discussion, getting their hands dirty in our farms, and really understanding dynamics of food justice and privilege and oppression, or diving into the actual aquaponic systems and the science of that, integrating with their science curriculum, talking about permaculture and those principles. So that's our service learning program. That's about 1,500, 2,000 students a year that participate in that. We also have a summer program for teenagers called Seed to Seed, that's like really a community leadership program that's building these teenagers into activists in their communities and training them to understand where their food comes from, what their diet is, and how that connects to heritage and health and justice, and then how to grow their own food and how to, we even teach them some entrepreneurship skills and things like that. So that's a really, really amazing program. We have lots of programs for community members, for adults in the community, everything from just how to grow your own food, how to raise animals, composting, things like that. An herbal medicine class that was asked for by residents, you know, a lot of them, because they're undocumented, can't get health insurance, even with Obamacare. So, you know, we're teaching them how to create tinctures and salves and things like that to take care of their bodies and their kids. And then we've recently been doing micro business training, helping them start a co-op around food-based enterprises. So, you know, a lot of these people in the community are amazing cooks. They're used to cooking for, you know, 50, 100 people at a time for baby showers and quinceañeras and stuff. So we're basically helping them take those skills, making that food a little bit healthy, maybe using some more local ingredients, marketing it across town, getting all their businesses licensed so that they can actually start generating more income for their families. So that's the community side of things. And then finally, for the general public, we do offer a permaculture design course here in Denver. It's a weekend course to make it as accessible as possible for working folks. We offer lots of scholarships so that people in that community and other similar low-income communities can take it. And that's just really a life-changing course, as most PDCs are. And so we really have a lot of fun doing that as well.
And who teaches your permaculture course?
So it's a whole group of folks. I'm one of the main teachers, along with a guy named Jason Gerhardt, a woman named Kelly Simmons, who's part of University of Colorado at Boulder, a woman, Isabel Sanchez, who works with me at the Grow House and does a lot of our community organizing work and community education. So it's a, you know, very diverse and broad skilled teaching team. And it's a big group. Our PDCs are larger than most. They're 40, 45 students. And so we find that having a lot of different teachers and splitting those groups up into smaller cohorts is a really amazing way to kind of draw on all of the diversity of Denver.
Wow. Okay, interesting. So, oh my gosh. It sounds like you guys have made a huge impact. And I'm curious about how the nonprofit, well, first of all, you know, the structure and the mission and the funding of nonprofits, you know, how do people collaborate and use the nonprofit structure in, you know, in addition to like an entrepreneurial venture, like a for-profit? How do you combine the two?
Yeah, well, that's a really excellent question. And first off, I'll say that, you know, as a permaculturalist, we're always looking at, you know, degenerative structures versus regenerative structures, right? And the classic example is, you know, like a car is degenerative because it starts falling apart the moment you start driving it, and it will never be as well-tuned as it is when you drive it off the lot. And a regenerative structure is like a fruit tree, right?
Yeah.
Which just gets, you know, gives you more and more yield as time goes by. And so looking under that analysis, a nonprofit's actually a degenerative structure usually, right? Like you usually have to put so much energy just into staying on that grants treadmill just to keep your nonprofit going.
Yeah.
And so I'm actually not a fan of nonprofits, or at least the traditional nonprofit, for that reason. And so neither was Paul, the developer who we started the Grow House with. But we decided to start the Grow House as a nonprofit, mostly because we had, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of renovations to do. And it would be a lot easier to fund those renovations with grants than with loans that we would have to pay back. But that being said, you know, we really think about our organization as, you know, what some people call a triple bottom line business, or what other people call a social enterprise. And so it's this idea that, you know, we're trying to integrate people, planet, and profit. And so, yes, we have this social mission. Yes, we're trying to, you know, heal our ecosystems around us. But we feel like we can't do that if we're not generating enough of our own income to sustain ourselves. So we do get grants, and about half of our budget comes from grants, but the other half comes from earned income, things we're doing that we charge for. So, you know, sometimes we half jokingly refer to it as one for the money, two for the hood. That's a phrase that I got from Ashara, who got it from a vegan chef named Bryant Terry. And the idea is that, you know, our main mission, of course, is working with folks right in our community of Elyria Swansea. But in order to fund that, we do very similar things for the general public that we charge, you know, sometimes a pretty high price for. So our farms, for example, we yield about 1,500 heads of lettuce every week out of those two farms. And a lot of that lettuce is sold to, you know, all these fancy hipster restaurants and Whole Foods and and places like that, that we charge a high price for. And then that allows us to get that same food to people in our community at a much lower price. Similarly with the education, you know, for those service learning workshops, we charge a lot of money for private day school students to come and take those service learning workshops. And then we offer those same workshops to people in our community at public schools for free. So it's that idea of everybody is getting something valuable out of it, but the people who can afford to pay more are paying a little bit more, and they're happy to do that because they know that that money is going to support the whole mission of the organization.
Wow, that is, I love social entrepreneurship, and I love the idea of fusing nonprofit work based on community needs with for-profit work and earning an income based on the value you're providing to people who can pay for it. And you know, I've learned a little bit about benefit corporations, and I know that if you have an LLC, you can kind of combine nonprofit with for-profit structures, but I'm not too clear on how that all works. So you guys are a 501c3, and that is technically a nonprofit, correct?
That's correct. And, you know, it is true. There's all these different legal structures that none of which is necessarily 100% suited to what it is we're talking about. There's LLCs, there's a new structure called L3Cs, there's B Corps, there's nonprofits. You know, oftentimes I find that the best legal structure to embody these principles is a cooperative that's owned by the employees, right?
Uh-huh.
Or owned by consumers. But really what I like to say is that the legal structure should follow the design of the organization. So like I said, for the Grow House, we went with a nonprofit because of all these grants we had to get just to renovate and get us to the point where we could start fulfilling our mission. But for another startup, you know, you might have very low startup overhead costs. And so an LLC might make more sense, or a cooperative. And so you shouldn't let the legal structure guide what your mission is. It should be the other way around. You should come up with your business plan and then figure out the structure from there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So are there like multiple organizations within Grow House? So like the physical building is a nonprofit, and then, you know, maybe like the business side is an LLC, or does it all work together under the nonprofit structure?
Yeah, the way we currently have it structured is there are right now two different entities, and pretty soon to be a third. So the Grow House is the nonprofit, the kind of umbrella organization. Colorado Aquaponics, which I mentioned earlier, is its own for-profit. I believe it's an LLC that rents one part of the Grow House that has the commercial aquaponics farm.
Right.
And then, you know, like I mentioned, we're working with this cohort of residents in the neighborhood to form what's probably going to be a co-op that does catering. And so that will be the third entity. But, you know, we've definitely talked in the past of breaking off some of these different things that the nonprofit does and basically spinning them off as their own for-profits or co-ops or things like that. So it remains to be seen how that all plays out, but we're definitely open to different alternatives.
Yeah, that I love the idea of it. And lately it's been really big on my mind, especially because of the idea of benefit corporations, and that ties in with the social entrepreneurship. And, you know, I would love to have someone on the show speak specifically on the legal structures and how you can make, you know, food as a community-driven mission with,
yeah,
like a for-profit structure with courses and things like that. And I have talked to Colorado Aquaponics, and uh-huh, they did talk to us about renting a part of the, you know, of the space, which I think is a brilliant business model. So
yeah,
I think, you know, I also am not really into nonprofits because, you know, you want to be able to sustain the longevity of the mission. And if people can't make a living or they're begging for money all the time, it needs to be driven by what the community is willing to pay for, as well as, what you can give, but what aspects of the community are able to reciprocate through income, you know?
Right. No, I definitely think that's ideal. And you know, I also recognize that we're very fortunate at Grow House to be in a city, Denver, that is thriving, has a lot of people moving to it that are very interested in these kinds of issues, and that frankly have a lot of money and are willing to pay some of that money for these kinds of earned income services that we're charging for. I also know that not every community across the country is like that. And so some of those other communities are going to have to find other creative solutions. You know, one of the things we say is that people ask us all the time, like, oh, are you going to open up a grow house in another part of town or another city? And you know, we say no, because every community has its own unique set of challenges and opportunities. And, you know, just because what we're doing is thriving in this neighborhood doesn't mean that if we took the same business model or same set of ideas that it would work even in the communities next door. So every group of people, every community is going to have to find what works for them. You know, it's not the specific business model or programs that we're running that are what make this successful. It's the approach. It's the mindset. It's that permaculture paradigm of observe and interact, small and slow solutions, integrate, don't segregate, that I think is really the key to what's making this work.
Awesome. So moving on, let's talk about maybe some of the challenges and also some of the successes that you guys have had at the Grow House.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I think there's, let's see, I'd say in general, our challenges could fall into a few different categories. There's, you know, the technical challenges, right, of just figuring out all of these systems from scratch, hydroponics and aquaponics and climate batteries and things like that. There are the financial challenges, of course, of, you know, raising that money in the first place. And then, you know, the things we were talking about actually trying to run some of these programs like a business and really make sure they're generating the income they need to and things like that. And, you know, those are all solvable. And I think there's a lot of great resources out there for them. But I think some of the biggest challenges were the social challenges, like I said, of earning the trust of this neighborhood, overcoming some of these very real cultural barriers. And a lot of it was, you know, these kind of internal challenges of, in order to really make this work, we all had to do a lot of internal work of really looking at our own privilege and our own kind of ways of getting things done, which might be more efficient or might, you know, look good to a funder, but actually might be disempowering to the residents who are most trying to help. And so really trying to deepen our own understandings of how privilege and oppression play out on all of these different levels and do our best to really engage community members as partners instead of, you know, clients or, you know, people who were deserving of handouts or, you know, that whole kind of colonialist mentality that, you know, as much as it's easy to hate on, is actually very pervasive and hard to truly decolonize in our own minds.
Right.
And so I think it's in some ways that's been one of the most rewarding parts of the process for me. But also, yeah, it's definitely been challenging because I feel like I'm always having to check myself and check my own privilege. And sometimes I haven't done it successfully and other people have to call me out on it. And at this point, you know, I welcome that, but it's never easy.
Yeah. So what's the main demographic of the people that you work with? You said they're Latinos, like from where?
Yeah. So there's a kind of very rich and amazing Chicano history in Denver. Denver was actually one of the national hubs of the Chicano organizing movement in the late 60s and early 70s, which is something that I didn't know until I started reading more books and stuff in the last few years.
Wow.
But it's a really fascinating history that's happened here of radical organizing. So there's some of that community of people who have been here for generations. And then there's also a lot of immigrants, mostly from Mexico, you know, Durango and Sinaloa and Chihuahua and places mm-hmm. like that. And then scattering of other places in, you know, Central America as well. But yeah, lots of recent immigrants, a lot of whom don't speak English, who may or may not be documented, lots and lots of kids in the neighborhood, things like that.
Okay. All right. Interesting. So what have been some of the biggest successes that you have had and since you've started?
Yeah, well, you know, I think early on, our bigger successes were, ironically enough, even though our mission was to serve that community, I think at first, we got a lot of attention from just kind of general Denver. And I think part of that had to do with, you know, the other co-founders, Paul and Ashara, were already pretty well known in Denver. And so they were like, oh, what's Paul and Ashara's new project? And there were all these articles about us. And it was, you know, this different wacky technology of aquaponics. And so there were lots and lots of people from outside coming. And that was great. And that got a lot of really important technical skills, people with skills on our side. And we got some good grant money for renovations and stuff like that. But it really took, like I said, a lot longer to engage the community. And we had to be very intentional about, you know, it would be easy to get distracted by all this outside attention and to, you know, do all these collaborations with organizations that were serving the general public. And we had to keep saying, no, actually, we have to hold ourselves back. We need to keep focusing on this community and winning over their hearts and minds. And eventually, you know, like I said, that was a success as well. And particularly bringing in folks like Isabel, what I call cultural translators, people who aren't just bilingual literally, but kind of have one foot in, you know, this new culture of permaculture and one foot in the historic roots of Latino culture, and that are able to make these new ideas accessible to those communities in a way that, you know, as a white dude who comes from an upper middle class background, I never could. And so, you know, by bringing on those cultural translators and really making these ideas, putting them in a different framework, then we really started to get more and more residents in the door. And now there's just so many people from the neighborhood that are such strong supporters of us that come in every week to, you know, help sort food baskets, or that have been coming to our classes and are now teaching classes. There's, you know, high school students that went through our Seed to Seed program 4 years ago that are now on our staff and teaching adults about how to make their diets more healthy, and, you know, just really, really cool stuff like that. So to me, that's one of the most inspiring success stories.
Oh, that is super cool. I've never heard of this idea of a cultural translator, but that's an excellent way to put it. You know, having someone mm-hmm. who has a foot in multiple cultures, like permaculture right. and Latino culture, and being able to be the bridge to show a different framework for the ideas that otherwise could be passed off as like another colonial, you know, another, even though we want to help. I mean, obviously permaculture transcends like this new ecological movement. I mean, it's old. It's just mm-hmm. we're designing with new technology and old technology at the same time.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's true that, you know, unfortunately, there are a lot of perpetuations sometimes of colonial attitudes and dominating attitudes that are done under the guise of permaculture or other similar things.
Yeah.
And it's not because people are doing it intentionally. I think everybody is coming in with good intentions. But, you know, like I said, it's a big challenge and an ongoing challenge to really examine all those dynamics within ourselves. And so if we're not doing that work and not being held accountable to it, we run the risk of perpetuating some of those things. And right now I'm actually just wrapping up guest editing an issue of Permaculture Design magazine that's all about decolonizing permaculture. And we've gotten just some amazing, amazing stories and submissions from people all across the movement, and a lot of permaculturalists who are people of color or people who come from kind of non-traditional backgrounds that aren't your typical people who you see in the spotlight, that are sharing their stories of how, you know, permaculture speaks to them, but also how they feel permaculture might have been alienating to them because of some of these mentalities that it's unintentionally perpetuating. So there's a lot of really great feedback and wisdom and advice in there that I've been really blessed to help put together.
Yeah, and another issue in the permaculture movement has been kind of the lack of women, you know, teaching and being, you know, public in the movement. It always seems to be dominated by men. I mean, but I adore permaculture. You know, I mean, the mm-hmm. permaculture is what got me started in all of this. And, you know, I agree, we need to have cultural translators and have people of different genders and different cultures bringing it into their own and representing it. And so anyway, this is definitely a good discussion.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to see that magazine when you're done with it. You said you're editing it?
Yep. Yeah. So I'm basically, you know, just collecting all the articles and formatting them and everything like that. It's if you're familiar with Permaculture Activist Magazine,
yeah,
it's being renamed Permaculture Design Magazine.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's basically an issue of what used to be called Permaculture Activist.
Okay.
And yeah, it will be coming out, I believe, the first week of November.
Sounds excellent. Let's see here. So would you like to talk about some of the actual systems that are happening at the grow house, and what kinds of things are you growing there?
Yeah, totally. So we have two commercial farms, like I mentioned. One is a hydroponic farm, and that was the first kind of renovation we did at the grow house, and it was intended to be that kind of income generator for a lot of the rest of our programming. It was part of that, you know, kind of triple bottom line philosophy, is that we wanted to do something that started making money to support our other stuff. And we went with hydroponics over aquaponics because at the time, you know, this was in 2009, 2010, we just weren't seeing any aquaponics systems across the country that were reliably producing commercial harvests. And I know they were out there, you know, but we, especially Paul and other people on the board, didn't quite feel like it was ready for prime time yet, whereas hydroponics was a proven technology. We knew that we could make it work, and so we went with that. And so it's been working fine ever since. But, you know, within a couple of years, we said, okay, we really would love to try out aquaponics as well. And so right next door to that commercial hydroponics farm, we built a commercial aquaponics farm. The hydroponics farm, they're both recirculating systems. The Hydro one uses a system kind of similar to NFT that's called NGS out of Spain. And then the aquaponics farm, you know, to the credit of JD and Tanya and their incredible team, mm-hmm. they've just really built a top-of-the-line system based a lot on the UVM model of the kind of deep water culture, the floating raft system. That's where most of the production is.
The UVI model.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. UVI model. But they also have a couple media beds with gravel where they're growing kind of bigger things like tomatoes. They have, for their seedlings, it's more like a flood tray. They have a wicking bed where it's not recirculating. It just kind of stubs out into that where they're raising some root veggies. Mm-hmm. So the idea is, you know, they're just have all these different systems in that kind of one system so that viewers can see all the different ways that you can use aquaponics, all the different techniques. But mostly the main crops, the cash crops, so to speak, are leafy greens, butterhead lettuce, kale, chard, basil, things like that in both of the hydroponic and aquaponics farms.
And as far as permaculture goes, what do you have that's integrating, you know, on the, do you have any land surrounding the greenhouse or is it just the greenhouse like in the middle of the city?
It is mostly just the greenhouse. You know, our physical footprint of the entire land is something like 23,000 square feet. And of that, 21,000 square feet is the building itself.
I see.
So yeah, we are getting as creative as we can with the little scraps of land that are not under the roof. So for example, in the little area between the sidewalk and the street, we've built a demonstration food forest with, you know, all kinds of perennial edibles that work well in our semi-arid climate here. And we're redirecting rainwater from the roof of the grow house underneath the sidewalk and channeling it into a little arroyo that waters that strip. And then inside, back inside the building, next to our commercial farms, which, you know, the general public can't go into for food safety reasons. There's big windows that you can see, but the big public area is what we call the Growasis. And that's where we have all of our classes and special events and stuff like that. And part of that is a tropical food forest with a climate battery. So we have fig trees and bananas and some citrus and
cool.
All kinds of, yeah, it's really, really fun in there.
You said you have banana trees in there too, right?
Yes, we do.
I've seen pictures of it. That's why I got so interested. So the Growasis is, it's in a building?
Yep, it's all under the same building. It's just that greenhouse building is subdivided. There's walls inside of it. And so, you know, part of it is the big Growasis event space and part of it is these two commercial farms. We also have, we just started a mushroom facility that's in a corner. And then the front space, which is actually the only part that's not a greenhouse. It's like an old, you know, wood frame barn structure is where we have a small indoor classroom and our little corner store market.
Okay, excellent. And you said the little tropical forest, is that in like raised beds or
we have a bunch of little things in the Growasis. We have some potted plants and stuff like that, but most of it is in one big raised bed all against the south wall that, you know, we sheet mulched and is about, you know, 4 feet deep and maybe 100 feet wide.
Awesome. Okay. That sounds so cool. So you're growing in the Growasis, you're growing figs, bananas. What else are you growing in there?
All kinds of different stuff. We have passion flowers that we're actually drying and are about to start selling to an apothecary. We have some papayas, some, you know, tropical nitrogen fixers. We do lots of different annuals as ground covers. We have some mobile raised beds on wheels that we plant different annuals in. In the kind of late winter, early spring, we have a big seedling area that these days more and more is being run by residents of the neighborhood as another kind of little business for them. So it changes based on the season and time of year and stuff like that. But yeah, the idea is to fill it with as much diversity, as much edible stuff as possible. And most importantly to be, you know, the Growasis, it's not a commercial farm. We're not trying to maximize our physical yield. We're more just trying to maximize the wow factor and to have all these people coming through the space see what's possible to grow and to have things that look cool and that taste really unique and that smell interesting to keep people's senses engaged.
That sounds so amazing. I really want to come visit you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did a lot of work in the tropics in Costa Rica and Nicaragua, planting all kinds of fruit trees and, you know, coffee and cacao and bananas, papayas, mangoes, oranges, limes. I mean, ground cover, swales, like, I mean, I love it. It's one of my favorite things. So the fact that you guys are doing it in Colorado in a building is really awesome.
Yeah, it's fun for sure.
And so are either of your papayas or bananas or other fruit trees, do they fruit?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're at this point, we've had the bananas for about a year, so it'll still be a little bit, at least a few months before they fruit. Our fig tree, which we got from a cutting from Jerome, has this kind of legendary fig tree at the Central Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute. It was a cutting of his, and that started fruiting within like 6 months. So we've been eating figs off that for a little while now. So yeah, I mean, we definitely have the right conditions in there in terms of temperature and pollinators and soil. So we're keeping our fingers crossed and hoping to see more and more fruit over the coming months and years.
Very cool. Do you guys ever pump any of your aquaponic or hydroponic water into them on occasion? Or
yeah, totally. Because, you know, as you know, we definitely get more nutrients from that aquaponic system than than we always need for the crops. So yeah, we take kind of buckets of the water and use that to kind of fertigate from time to time. And that's, you know, one of the really fun volunteer activities we do with our service learning groups.
You probably take some of the fish waste as well, the solids that they that they filter and add them in there.
You bet.
Yeah. Have you guys started selling any of that? Any of the, or I don't know if Colorado Aquaponics has actually, I'm not sure. I probably asked him this, if he sells any of the fish solids as fertilizer.
Yeah. You know, I think they set up a little display about 6 months back where they tried selling the fish solids. And I don't think they found it was really worth it. There wasn't quite the market for it, at least at the time. I think it's something that they do more on an ad hoc basis. But the truth is, you know, the amount of solids that they generate is probably just about right for our own internal needs. And it's not so much that they're, you know, selling it all over town.
Yeah. Well, great. Finally, I would love for you to talk about the intersection of aquaponics with the food justice and permaculture movements.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, I think in some ways we've kind of been talking about it already, or at least dancing around it. But in particular, you know, I see aquaponics as a really powerful tool for what we call food sovereignty, right? There's this idea that food security is just providing the calories for people in a community that might be currently experiencing hunger. And that's great. But food sovereignty takes it to the next level, where it's really the community deciding what kind of food they're eating and how much and what varieties and how it's connected to their traditional heritage and their climate and things like that. And so I think aquaponics is a really powerful tool for that in the right hands and if it's done in the right way. And we're really trying to do that at Grow House and, you know, in an industrial urban neighborhood like we're in. You know, I forgot to mention, but where we're located, it's the most polluted zip code in the entire state of Colorado.
Wow.
And so, you know, your typical idea of backyard gardens is a little bit sketchy because a lot of the soil is contaminated. So aquaponics provides a way, whether it's at the home scale or at the community scale like we're doing, to provide that food sovereignty and food security without having to dig into that potentially contaminated soil. So I think it's a really powerful tool for that reason as well. And obviously, you know, it's amazing because it not only provides the veggies, but also protein occasionally. So it really is that kind of whole system.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, and actually we've seen how the aquaponics water, if you're using it in overflow, you know, if there was an overflow, how it can regenerate dead soils, or, you know, what you would call dirt, or even potato rock in Hawaii has completely transformed it into a living, breathing, diverse, active soil that actually absorbs water rather than, you know, slicks it off. Or, and so I'd like to see in the future of aquaponics how we can use it to regenerate soils and even polluted landscapes in the future.
Yeah, I believe it. And I think that's a really worthy goal.
So thanks, Adam, for such a great, you know, a great chat with you. Is there anything you'd like to share with our aquapreneurs and other permaculturists out there?
Yeah, I guess just, you know, like I said, be on the lookout for that issue of the magazine. If any of your listeners are interested in some of those topics of decolonizing permaculture, or, you know, even aquaponics, if you don't identify as a permaculturalist, I think a lot of the same concepts will apply. There's a lot of great stuff in there. And then kind of on the bit more long term, I'm actually taking a lot of what I've learned from the Grow House and other projects I've been involved in, and I just signed a deal to write a book on social permaculture. And so,
if
folks are interested in learning more about, you know, things like cultural translators and social enterprise and things like that, yeah, be on the lookout for that. I'll actually be launching a crowdfunding campaign in October to help finance some of that. So
excellent. Thank you. And I love social permaculture. I think that, you know, invisible structures, which is, you know, one of the topics in permaculture that we least talk about,
exactly,
is super important. Just like we were saying about, you know, structuring a business or a nonprofit and how you involve the community, all of that stuff, all of these invisible structures like land grants and cooperatives, these are essential for us. And I think that we need to start looking at social permaculture more and more. So
yeah, I couldn't agree more. So that's why I'm writing the book.
Thank you so much, Adam. It's been such a pleasure.
Yeah, my pleasure, Marabou. It's been an awesome conversation, and I look forward to hearing more.
Thank you for listening to the Visionary Aquaponics Podcast. To learn more about aquaponics, please visit our website at www.visionaryaquaponics.com. There you'll find more strategies, tips, and tricks to get you started in your aquaponics journey.